I'm Maya McNulty, and this is the Fundraising Secrets Podcast, made for Fundpreneurs. Fundpreneurs is a heart-centered leader. Fundpreneurs take no BS and make no apologies for serving the public. Fundpreneurs unite and thrive knowing that together we will prevail. Fundpreneurs will fight for the cause, raise awareness, and serve with humility. Fundpreneurs are resourceful, compassionate, and philanthropy is our middle name. Fundpreneurs deploy the organization's task with honor and champions the mission. Fundpreneurs enrich lives and put ethics before conversions. Fundpreneurs define strength in numbers, believe in the cause, create the future, build fundraising empires, impact the world. Fundpreneurs are driven and inspired knowing that we are making fundraising fun. I'm a Fundpreneur. Welcome back. You're listening to Fundraising Secrets, and I'm Maya McNulty, your host. Thanks for joining me, everyone. Today, we have a super special show. One of the organizations that's actually changing lives of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people across the globe. And today, what a privilege it is that I have the honor, the immense privilege, to sit and talk with Frank Shanks, with the founder and CEO, former CEO, right? But you are the founder of Make-A-Wish. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the invite. We've had a couple days of fun here in Albany. Right?
Yes.
With Sharon Bernstein's event.
Yes, here at Leadership Summit America. Yeah. So I really appreciate you carving out a little time before you head back. I know you're headed off to...
Home is Arizona, but headed off to California. We've got a couple TV appearances we're doing to promote our movie, Wishman.
Yeah, so we're going to dive deeper and talk about Wishman. But before we talk about Wishman, we really want to find out, and my audience too, and other nonprofits, because you are the leader. You're the iconic leader. Like, you are the, when they say cream rises to the top, it's like Frank's in the building, everybody. Like, listen to what Frank is saying. So I know that I stop in my tracks when you come in the room, just your presence, besides the fact that you're a tall cowboy, that I just like, that is somebody that charismatically is a leader, and that's the kind of person I want to be and inspire. So you've done, I mean, we've met 3 years ago here at Leadership Summit. Mm-hmm. We're reconnected again, and it's taken some time to get to know each other a little better. I threw my book in your face and said, hey, do you want my book? And you're like, yes, I love to have fundraising secrets. So this is exciting. So for our listeners, let's talk about your backstory. And we had the privilege of watching Wishman last night. So we're going to talk about that.
Oh, good,
but tell
good,
your backstory. What an amazing show. Go ahead, movie.
Yeah, and I'm going to correct you a little bit. I'm a creator and the co-founder of the Make-A-Wish Foundation. I never want to take away from the other four people that helped me put all this together. If it wasn't for them, this would have never happened. But back in the 80s, I was a motorcycle, 1980s, a motorcycle officer with Arizona Highway Patrol, and there was a television show called Chips that was very popular back then.
I remember Chips.
And the people that don't remember Chips, it was the adventures of two California Highway Patrol motorcycle officers, Ponch and John, played by Larry Wilcox and Eric Estrada. And it was a very popular show, especially with the younger set. For the kids' ages, the demographics were about 7 to 15 or 16. For the girls, the demographics were about 7 till about 55 or 60 because of Eric Estrada. His smile.
Yeah, so cute, too.
Yeah. But friend of a family called Arizona Highway Patrol and said, we have a 7-year-old boy, and his name is Chris. His heroes are Ponch and John from Chips. And when he told his mother, when I grow up, I'm going to be a motorcycle officer just like Ponch and John. And the problem is he has terminal leukemia, and he only has about 5 or 6 days to live. And is there any way that the Highway Patrol could send a motorcycle officer, have him come to our headquarters and meet a motorcycle officer? And the department got very involved. Yes, we can. And I just happened to be that motorcycle officer they chose. I was on a 10-man motorcycle unit that worked the whole state of Arizona, 2 weeks in one town, 2 weeks in another town. And when we had time, we would go to some of the grade schools and talk about bicycle safety, which the kids could care less about. They just wanted to get on the motorcycles because it was just like Ponch and John. Mm-hmm. In fact, we originally trained with California Highway Patrol in Sacramento. And our uniforms, our equipment was identical, except obviously ours at Arizona. So when we're riding in town, two-man teams, hey, Ponche, John, the kids, it was great PR. And I think that's the reason I was chosen. And they set it up where I was way up in the mountains of northern Arizona when I got the call from a dispatcher, check out at a telephone. There's no cell phones during these days. And it's emergency traffic, not involving your family. I had no idea what to expect. They explained it to me. And they said, we want to get you into Phoenix just on the landing zone at our headquarters as the helicopter's coming in so this little boy can see the motorcycle and motorcycle officer, which they did. They timed it just perfect through radio calls, what's going on. I'd never met this little boy. I had no idea what to expect. I knew he had terminal leukemia. I knew he only had a few weeks to live. Helicopter lands, door opens up, and I thought our paramedics are going to help him out of the helicopter. Little red pair of sneakers jumps out of that helicopter, runs over the motorcycle, big smile. Hi, I'm Chris. Can I get on your motorcycle? Well, of course you can, Chris. And he is just having so much fun. Now, he watched Chip so much, and our motorcycles are identical. This is a siren. Can I turn it on? These are the red lights. What's in your saddlebag? The same as Punch. He wants to know.
So cute.
And I'm laughing. The guys around are laughing. I'm looking at his mother, and she's crying. And why is she crying? Because this little boy, then it dawned on me, she's got her 7-year-old back. He just came off of a hospital bed with IVs, and now he's running all over the place. Mm-hmm. Well, Chris went on to become the first and only honorary highway patrol officer in our history back then, complete with his own badge, which is still assigned to him today, the smoky hat that the troopers wore, and his certificate making him official honorary highway patrolman. And his doctor who was with him told his mother, I don't understand what's going on. His vitals are so good, let's let Chris go home tonight to his comfort zone instead of back to the hospital, which he did. Now, we're feeling good about what's happening. One of the officers said, we got a little patrolman, but he needs a uniform. And they were custom made in those days. We go to the uniform shop just as they're closing. We said, we've got this little boy, 7 years old. He's about this high, this wide. Can you make a uniform for Chris? Two ladies spent all night making this custom made uniform for Chris. I got permission the next day to lead several motorcycles, highway patrol cars, into his neighborhood, his house, about 8 in the morning, red lights and sirens. You can imagine the kids, right? I mean, the neighbors. Chris comes running out, a big smile. We hand him his uniform. He's a quick change artist. He runs in and comes out just strutting. He's got on a smoky hat, the uniform. But he comes over to me, and he says, can I get on your motorcycle again? Well, of course you can, Chris. And he starts rubbing the wings the motorcycle officers wear on their uniform. And he said, this is the first time I heard this word, he said, I wish I could be a motorcycle officer. And I just started teasing him, and I told him the training we're doing. I said, it's a shame you don't have a motorcycle, Chris. We'd set up traffic cones right in your driveway and test you right now. Just kind of teasing him a little bit.
Yeah.
He runs in the house and comes riding out on a little battery-operated motorcycle.
Love it.
That his mother had got for him in place of a wheelchair. He's got on the helmet we gave him, where he got aviator glasses like where, I have no idea. But on a ranch we call the high-top rubber mucking boots. His mother got him a pair of those. He's got his pant leg uniform tucked in. Looks like a motorcycle officer. He's ready. He goes through the cones. He comes back real serious. Did I pass? Well, yes, you did, Chris. Am I a motorcycle officer now? Yes, you are, Chris. When do I get my wings? Very stern. And I said, Chris, those are special order. I'll get those wings for you. You promise? Yes, I promise I'll get those wings. Well, I did order them when the day was over. I get a call a couple days. The wings are ready. I go to the jeweler. I pick them up. The dispatcher calls me on the police radio. Again, call into our office. Chris is in a coma in the hospital. Probably not going to survive the day. You're authorized to go to the hospital. So I go to the hospital. I walk in his room. It's just him and his mother. I look, and his uniform was hanging right by his bed. Just as I pinned the wings in that uniform, Chris came out of the coma. Very weak. He looks. He gets a real faint smile on his face, a low voice. Am I a motorcycle officer now? Yes, you are, Chris. His wish had become true. And unfortunately, he passed away a couple hours later. And I was like to think maybe those wings helped carry him to heaven. Now, our commander called me back in a couple days later, and he said, we just learned that Chris is going to be buried in Kewaunee, Illinois, a little town away from Chicago. And he said, I'd like you and your partner to go back and give him a full police funeral because we have lost a fellow officer. Well, of course we'll do that. And he said, now, the good news is it's authorized. You can go back. You can travel in uniform. We've got everything cleared for you. The bad news is we can't cover any expenses, and you have to cover your own airfare, and you're going to have to take vacation time. It's an unauthorized. Okay, we'll do that. The other good news is we've already started passing the hat, and we're going to get full expenses for you, which they did. I mean, all over the state of Arizona, different police agencies, not just the Highway Patrol, helped out to get these funds to get us in. And again, before the days of internet, we're driving up to Kewaunee, about 180 miles from Chicago. And we get this little town, and I look, and all of a sudden there's Illinois State Police cars, city police cars, county police cars. The word had gotten out via, and we didn't know it was all over television,
wow,
that we're up there to bury this little young trooper. And he did get a full police funeral, buried in his uniform, and his grave marker reads, Chris Gracious, Arizona Trooper. Now, the press picked us up right away. We had the major networks from Chicago were there. And I just started realizing all the tensions is getting, and we're flying home, and I'm just starting thinking, his little boy had a wish, and we made it happen. Why can't we do that for other children? And that's when the idea was born, maybe 36,000 feet over Kansas or something.
Well, let's back it up. Like, that's such a beautiful story, and that's the making of Make-A-Wish, right?
Right.
The original story told from Frank himself. Mm-hmm. So here you heard it first, guys, here on Fundraising Secrets. I want to know a little bit more about you, Frank, though, before that heroic story, right? The life, that story that's impacting the lives of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people globally. Tell us a little bit about your background. You had your mom and your dad in Chicago and then in Arizona. Tell us a little bit about that. And I know it's a touchy subject for you because...
Well, it's not. I mean, it's everybody, every little venture we're talking about has helped develop character and integrity. And I'm so fortunate in my life. I was born in Chicago. At 2 years old, my mother divorced my father and left. We never had any idea where she went. Even in her later years, she would never tell me. And it was a great life from 2 to 5. I mean, aunts, uncles, grandparents, just so much family fun. My father's side of the family, just he's always joking around. Just a good family time. I'm in kindergarten, 5 years old, in a playground, and this lady grabs me and says, I'm your mother, you're going with me, we're going to Arizona. I had no idea who this lady was. I couldn't remember her whatsoever from age 2. I mean, that transition right from there. Kicking and screaming and a couple smacks on the head. And this is a crazy lady. But she did. She forced me in the car. And she took a strange route to Arizona. She went up to northern Michigan, up in the UP. Now, we didn't have geography yet.
In kindergarten. No Google Maps.
So I don't know where we're going, really. But all of a sudden, I know we're by a great big lake. And she pulls into a campground. I didn't even know what a campground was. But she said, this is a campground. This is where we're going to live all summer. Look, and we pull up in front of a tent. I'm coming from a very nice apartment where my grandparents had. All of a sudden, in the middle of nowhere, and this is going to be home in a tent. And it just scared the heck out of me at first.
Sure.
And the biggest thing was, she said, we have very little money, and I'm going to be gone all day. She's a little town up there working. In fact, a fish processing plant where she was working, and we don't have a lot of food. Now, I never had a problem with my German grandparents with food.
Yeah.
But she says, I'm leaving you a peanut butter jelly sandwich for breakfast. There's another one for lunch, and I'll be home at night for dinner. So that was it. And she took all the food with her.
That's
because she didn't want me. You know, you're a kid. You're hungry all the time.
Yeah.
And
to ration it.
Yeah, that was the first thing. And again, a tent. All of a sudden, in a camp cot, we're in a tent that leaks, camp stove and everything. Nothing I'd ever experienced. But after now several months of this, I'm starting to really enjoy it. I'm liking this camping. I'm liking being by myself all day, exploring the woods. I went right on the lake, exploring the lake. Even taught myself how to swim by watching other people. Mm-hmm. And towards when winter started coming, the snow started coming, then we got out of the tent, and we lived in a car for a while, and then she found an old ratty farmhouse, but at least it was shelter. So for the next 5 years, it was like that, back and forth. But again, I started liking this rural life. I started learning survival, how to take care of myself. When I was 10 years old, my father found us, and again, up in Michigan, and he went in to get the sheriff to have her arrested because of a kidnapping charge. And when he was gone, she threw everything we had, dragged me again in a car. She said, we're going to Arizona. And it took about 6 weeks to get to Arizona because she didn't have enough money. So she'd pull in a little town, get a job as a waitress, get enough tip money. She never took the salary, but the tip money to get gas and a loaf of bread or something like that. And we'd sleep in the car for 6 weeks. We get into Arizona, and just this little town of Seligman, Arizona, which is on Route 66, which nobody's ever heard of. But if anybody remembers the TV or the movie Cars, the Disney animated movie Cars, Radiator Springs is in Seligman, Arizona. That's where they modeled that town from Seligman, Arizona. 500 people, a railroad town, obviously a tourist town, and that was about it. Predominantly Mexican Indian in the town. Very few white, or gringos as they called us. But just out of town, she completely ran out of gas. And she, first time I ever saw her cry in all these years. And, Mom, what's wrong? And she says, we have no money. We have nothing. We have no food. That was it. Everything is gone. I don't know what to do. So I'm kind of frightened on that. Just then a rancher pulls up in a pickup. Hi, what's wrong? Can I help you? This is this typical West type thing. Mm-hmm. And she just told him what's going on. He said, you stay here. I'm going to go to the ranch, get a gas can. We'll get some gas in here. You follow me back to the ranch, and you're going to stay with us until we can figure something out. Now, it's a very small ranch house, but it's warm. It's cozy. Our bed was on the kitchen floor in a couple bedrolls, but we're warm. It's starting to already snow in northern Arizona. And for the first time, food regular for breakfast, biscuits and gravy. God, I love biscuits and gravy. Little boy, now you're 10 years old, you're really hungry. But we had to find work, and she got a job right away as a motel maid, not making hardly any money at all. They paid her 50 cents a room to clean a room, and there were 10 rooms, so she's not making any money at all. I got a job as a dishwasher. I'm 10 years old. I'm working full-time. Well, 38 hours a week was all they could let me work. But I'm making 60 cents an hour and working full-time. But all that money I made went to my mother. And after about 6 weeks at the ranch house, the rancher found an old wrecked travel trailer for us. And he said, I'm going to bring it into property. I'm going to fix it up because now we're kind of a burden on them. We can't do this every day. And got that fixed up enough where we had heat, we had running water, but not hot water, and the toilet didn't work. Mm-hmm. But now we have shelter, and they put it behind this old motel where my mother was working on the dirt road, and at least we could hook up electricity in that. And people said, well, how did you clean? How did you take care of yourself? Well, Santa Fe was what they called the division point for the railroad. As the big freight trains came in, they had a big round table steam yard. They would hook up the big, huge old locomotives to get these freight trains over the mountains. And then coming back, and they would change crews. And the crew quarters, showers, men's showers and that, they had all the hot water you want. And they would allow the boys in town, unfortunately not the girls, but the boys in town, they didn't have the women's locker room. And we could go out there and shower and use the facilities. And people taught us how you only got one or two sets of clothes. You wash your clothes while you're in the shower and then put on your new ones. So it's always clean. Cleanest kid in town. But it's during that period, I'm working at the cafe. And the cafe that I was washing dishes at, they didn't give away food. Even though you're employed, you had to pay for your meals. So that was always an issue because my mom, why you can't buy meals. I need that money. Mm-hmm. I watch him one day, and there's across the street. I've been watching this Mexican fellow build something. I don't know what. And I went over and I said, hi, what are you doing? He says, what's your name? I said, Frank. He said, you know, from now on, you're Pancho, meaning Frank in Spanish. And he said, grab a hammer, kid. Now, I never had this father figure to teach me anything. And I said, and he said, my name's Juan. I always love this. My name's Juan, but the people in town call me Juan. And I looked at the hammer, and he said, you know what you're doing? I said, no, I've never done any of this. He said, I'm going to teach you. And just started out with the basic, how to nail something, and how to use a saw, how to help them build this thing. And then what it was called a snow cap, like a Dairy Queen. But on Route 66, just became iconic because of Juan's personality. Now, 50-some years later, tour buses from Las Vegas, 170 miles, go there just to stop to meet the family and see the picture of these places that's still there. So Juan became my father figure, my mentor. I never was involved in any type of sports. And in Seligman, it's the first time we lived in a town. We never lived in a town before. Got me involved with sports, especially basketball. I'm already 6 foot tall at that age, now 12, and introduced me to the coach, and they had a JV team, grade school team. And the coach says, wow, I'm going to teach you, and he did. I mean, I had never played this, but all of a sudden I'm on the first string, as they say. later on, I want to learn football. Well, they didn't have any of that. They had a high school team. Juan goes and talks to the coach. He said, can he just practice, learn the fundamentals? So here I'm this little, you know, 12-year-old kid with the high school kids knocking the heck out of me, but I learned the sport. The same with music. He introduced me to music. Became a total father figure. But one day he's talking, and he said, Frank, he says, I want you to remember, everybody in this town is always helping you and your mom, and when you can, give back. Juan, what do you mean give back? The poor people are taking care of us. We don't have a thing. He said, you don't have to have money to give back. The biggest lesson I've ever learned from him, one of the bigger lessons, you can give back your time. What do you mean, Juan? He said, look at Widow Sanchez. Look at her front yard. It's full of weeds. Look at her porch. It needs painted. It needs peeled and scraped. She's always bringing you and your mom beans and tortillas. She's always helping you out. You can give back by taking care of that. I understood. Clean up that yard, help paint everything else. Another example, look at Mr. and Mrs. Ortega. Same thing, they're helping you out. They've got an old wrecked caboose from the Santa Fe line that's going to be their home that they're bringing in, and they're trying to clean it up and paint it. You can give back. And I just remembered that lesson my whole life. When I started seventh grade, I coming home, and I look, and our trailer is being hooked up to a pickup, and I ask my mom what's going on, and she says, I can't afford you anymore. I'm leaving. And that was about it. It just, my home drove away. What the heck am I going to do? And I went to Juan, and he said, I know what's going on. And I was devastated, obviously.
Sure.
And Juan said, I know what was going to happen. And I've arranged for you to live with the Widow Sanchez. And he said, you've got to learn the term. And this is it's a very popular term now, but out of those years, turn that negative thing into a positive thing. What do you mean? My home just left me. How can that be positive? And he said, you make $26 a week, and she's going to charge you $20 a week, room and board. He said, for the first time in your life, you get $6 of your own in your own pocket. Now, in the 50s, that's a lot of money for a kid.
Yeah.
A lot of money. And he said, that's a positive. He said, the other thing, all of a sudden, you're going to be living in a home. For the first time in your life, you're going to have your own room. That was definitely a positive. That little couch in the trailer, I didn't quite fit in
anymore.
Yeah. He said, another positive, you got indoor plumbing. You're not going to have to run over to the locker room at the Santa Fe all the time to clean up. I said, another positive is she's the best cook in town. Well, there's no argument on that.
Yeah, sign me up.
And I got meals all the time now.
Yeah.
And the biggest positive for me was she got the first television set in Seligman, Arizona. And we got three channels. One of them was the Mickey Mouse Club.
I love it.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I always say that how positive and negative, right? So I always say if something negative is happening to me, I always say it's happening for me, not to me. And so when I started to say that to myself, because I've had a lot of things happen throughout my career, and now I always say it was happening for me, not to me. And since I've made that shift, amazing things. Like, I'm so honored to be able to sit with you and have quality time. That's my love language, by the way. Even though I'm boisterous and outgoing and exciting and everything, but quality time is my love language. And that really, for you sitting here and having this interview one-on-one and learning more about you and the audience hearing more about you, you're such a humble man, so kind and generous, and so I could see why you were the co-founder of Make-A-Wish. You're making my wish come through right now, and I'm not even asking.
But again, it's all the people that's helped me out in my life, helped me develop character and integrity, and that's one of the things that Juan said. Those three traits are not inherited. They have to develop. You start as a kid, it continues through your adult life.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm going to take that and run with it. So it's happening for me, not to me, and make it positive, turn it around. So, it's attitude, having the positive attitude. Mm-hmm. So let's fast track a little bit. So now how did you become a police officer?
Following high school, and when I was in eighth grade, my mother came back to Seligman and said, I need you to move to Prescott, where we currently live. She says, I can't afford it. I need you to come there, get a job, work full-time, and help me out. Now, we didn't have a close relationship, obviously, but Juan always said, remember, she's your mother. You will respect her. And I did throughout our life. I mean, we never, again, had that close relationship. So I moved to Prescott, got a job right away, but all of a sudden I'm in a bigger town. I think it was 2000 at that time, but to me, a big town. a different school system. I could get on the professional, not professional, but high school sports, made first team right away because Juan teach me the basics.
Plus, you're a pretty big guy. I don't know if anybody's ever met you, but you're pretty tall. I mean, I wouldn't mess with you.
But again, just the coaches, the teachers helping me out, and they're my employer helping me out, especially employer, because I'm working full time. But he said, when it's a football game night, basketball game night, whatever it is, you're going to take off. You're going to go do the team. You're going to do your thing. And you're also going to go to the after-school dance, after-team dance. But then you got to come back and finish your shift. So it'd be at about midnight or 1 in the morning because we're stocking shelves and everything else. But again, helping out. I mean, other people, no, you can't go. You can't go. You're working. So again, helping out. But finally, high school, went into the Air Force. 4 years in the service, honorable discharge, stationed overseas, is Vietnam era, but I'm not a Vietnam in-country veteran. And following the Air Force, went to work for Motorola in Phoenix, Arizona. And the reason that happened is, while I'm in England, Motorola is recruiting people with top secret clearances, which I had. And the reason, it's kind of funny on this, this is the 60s, mid-60s, sex, drugs, rock and roll era, hippie bands and everything else. The engineers that were graduating out of college, because this was the Atlas missile program that they were putting together, government contracts, and the engineers graduating out of college couldn't pass a drug test. Majority of them, if even using marijuana or any other type of drugs, no, you cannot have a top secret clearance. So they recruited us. When we got to Motorola, back to the Phoenix, they not only sent us to college, but used a GI Bill to go to college, and ended up, my math teachers crack up on this in high school, ended up as a statistical engineer. Figuring out the probability of failure rate of certain components of that missile. When is it going to fail? How many hours is set to the shelf life in that? Great job at Motorola. I mean, the pay was unbelievable. Several of my high school, going back to your original question, several of my high school friends, when they graduated and when they turned 21, joined the Arizona Highway Patrol. And I kept saying, Frank, with your background, with your engineering, with your Air Force experience, you'd be a perfect fit. I said, guys, I'm making 1 week what you make in a month. The first time in my life I'm making some money. And I just don't want to do that. Motorola, like I said, treated me great. But after 7 years, I'm living in the big city. I don't like the big city. I'm a little town guy. Mm-hmm. And the job got kind of boring. It's basically the same thing every day, and I was always kind of an adrenaline junkie. And just for whim, I put in an application with Highway Patrol. That particular one, there were 1,000 applications were submitted. They were choosing 50. The majority of them failed because they couldn't pass a drug test. Again, that same thing. They called up and said, you've passed everything. Do you want to join? Yes, I do. The academy starts. Best career choice I ever made. 42 years later, I finally retired. But I was first stationed down in Yuma, Arizona. This is on the California-Mexico border, Arizona border. And while there, this is a car officer. And I'm still taking college courses at junior college there just to stay up to date on things. And one of the football coaches came up and said, hi, and introduced himself. He said, I know your coach from high school. And he said, have you ever heard of Special Olympics? Well, coach, no, what is that? And he explained the whole program. He said, on your days off or some of your free time, would you work with these kids? Well, that sounds like fun. He says, yeah, I'd like to teach them the football throw. They have the football throw, the baseball throw, the basketball hoops and that. I had more fun with these kids. And all of a sudden, I started to think, Juan, I think I'm starting to give back. Because he always said, when you can, give back.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't cost you anything.
Yeah, and always, I was always so busy and everything. And this is the first time. In 1974, the Arizona Highway Patrol said, we want to start a 10-man motorcycle tax squad. And this is, you guys are going to work over the whole state of Arizona, 2 weeks in one town, 2 weeks in another town. And I was one of the people they would like to go to the motor school to see if I could pass to be on this tax squad. Well, I love motorcycles all my life, so I tried, I passed, got on the squad. And this is what we're related to now, talking about chips, that as we start going to towns, now the little kids are waving this and that. But an act happened. We were in a little town called Park, Arizona, 2,000 people. It's right on the California-Arizona border, separated by the Colorado River. During Easter break, it rose to 80,000 to 85,000 people because of kids coming over from the colleges. Again, sex, drugs, rock and roll. I mean, Then we brought our whole unit in there along with usually 30 patrol cars because this was so crazy. Fatal accidents, stabbings, rapes, you name it, just going on with this crazy with these kids. I'm in a high-speed chase with a drunk driver, 80 miles an hour, in a 25 zone. Another drunk driver pulls right in front of me. I hit him broadside and was pronounced dead at the scene. Now, that was a life-changing event, being dead. But, and I learned this later on. My partner tried to revive me, couldn't do it. And the code, I listened to radio tapes later, 963A, officer killed in the line of duty. An off-duty emergency room nurse from California stopped. And again, I'm learning this later. Let me try and revive him. He's dead. We can't do it. Well, where you and I are talking, and she didn't listen, thank God.
Yeah.
And almost 4 minutes performed CPR, which is extremely exhausting if anybody's ever performed CPR.
Yeah, I'm actually CPR certified.
Because
so
you know what I'm talking
I know exactly.
About.
I'm yeah. around so many people, and I host so many events that it was. I felt like first aid and CPR are two things that I really should have under my belt so that I'm prepared if anything should happen.
Yeah, and 4 minutes, like you know, extremely
exhausting
for somebody.
Yes.
Because we usually, on ourselves, we usually do teams. We trade back and forth so we don't get to completely exhausted. But obviously brought me back to life. And it took a long time to recover from that accident. Massive skull fracture, brain injury, everything else, broken bones, missing skin. And towards the end of the counseling period, the counselor said to me, Frank, you know you died. Well, yeah, okay. And you know God spared you for a reason. Now, every police officer I've ever worked with, including myself, we believe in a higher being. You go to whatever religion that might be, or not even organized religion, but you leave it in a higher being. We go to work every day, we say a little prayer, please allow me to come home. You get home at night, thank you for allowing me to come home.
Sure.
And he said, it's up to you now to find that reason. And it was 2 years later that when we started this conversation that I get the call while I'm way up in the mountains in northern Arizona, Frank, there's a 7-year-old boy.
Right.
And that 7-year-old boy was the reason.
Amazing. What an amazing story. Now, there are nonprofits that listen to Fundraising Secrets, and they probably think right out of the gate that Make-A-Wish was successful. So shed some light on that.
Well, it was. Again, this nobody's ever heard of anything like this. The hardest thing to do in Arizona and a lot of states, for the IRS, you have to have 5 board members. And the Arizona Corporation required that before we could even file our 501c3. Now, Chris's mother who came back, yes, I want to do this. Finding the other 3 people, this will never work. It's a bad idea. I don't have the time. And it took almost 6 months to find those other people. We finally filed our and got our 501c3 6 months later in the November of 1980. The people in Arizona started liking the idea. For some reason, I'm always on TV beforehand. The fatal accident, so on. They got the camera in my face. And all around, because I'm all around the state and got to know these people very well. So they started featuring me on that, and we raised enough money. We had about $2,000, and in March of 1981, we did our first official wish. Chris was the inspiration to start it. And again, and we started this with our children with terminal illnesses because leukemia was a death sentence. None of these children survived. And we were formed of a little boy, a little Mexican boy, Frank, middle name Bopsy Salazar, first name Frank Poncho. So, and again, leukemia, again, only a few weeks to live. I was his wish granter, as we call it. We go out and interview the children of what they want for a wish. And this is the first one that we learned later. Make sure you interview the children because the parents, oh, go to Paris, go here. It's not what the child wants.
Yeah, they might just want a motorcycle.
Yeah.
A motorcycle ride in a uniform and some wings.
So I interviewed Bopsy and just talking to him. And is there, and make a wish, do you want to have something, be something, do something, see something? And he's thinking about it. And he says, I want to be a fireman. Now, I borrowed a patrol car, and I'm in uniform, and he's sitting inside the patrol car. I said, a fireman? You're sitting in a cop car, and you want to be a fireman? And Bopsy's kind of shy. Now I finally got a giggle out of him.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, boy, my girlfriend's brother is a Phoenix fireman. We can do that. And he says, no, I want to ride in a hot air balloon. And I thought, well, I've got friends up in Prescott that have a hot air balloon. I know we can do that. And he said, no, I want to go to Disneyland. And I thought, ooh, we never thought about a travel wish out of state because we don't, you know, we're not that have much money yet. And I said, well, let me go talk to the people and let's see if we can make one of those wishes come true. And I'm the first president and CEO. I go to the board and I say, what I'd like to do is break the charter right now. Child only gets one wish, and we're going to grant all three wishes to Bobsy. And then why would we do that? I said, because we're going to get so much press out of this that it's going to make us grow immediately. Mm-hmm. Well, we did. Phoenix Fire came through. I mean, they made him the full turnout uniform, his size. Doc sliding down the fire pole, spraying cars outside with a fire truck. Hot air balloon, the same thing. Disney was a different story. Our secretary kept calling Disney with the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Well, they had never heard of us. We understand that. We'd like free admission to the park for this little boy. He's terminal illness. He's in a wheelchair. Also, keep in front of the lines. And Disney kept. We learned later that Disney gets these bogus requests all the time. And I'm sorry, we can't help you because they had no idea who we were. Our secretary says, I don't know what to do. I said, well, give you the name and the number and who you're talking to. And it's the secretary of public relations. So I call over there, and instead of saying, this is Frank Shankless, president of Make-A-Wish Foundation, I said, this is Officer Frank Shankless, Arizona Highway Patrol. And you can almost in your mind imagine that she's kind of setting up a little bit. What is this about? And I said, well, I need to talk to the director of public relations. Well, what is this about? And I said, I have a warrant for one of your people.
Oh, no.
Now, guess who I got to talk to right away?
The decision maker.
But... the minute I got the gentleman on the phone, I said, this is Officer Frank Shankless. Here's my name. Here's my badge number. Here's my supervisor's name and telephone number. All you have to do right now is call, because I just lied to you, and I'll be terminated immediately. But will you please listen to my story? Well, he listened to my story, and now 40 years later, because of Bobsy, Disney being one of the biggest supporters ever of the foundation, I mean, just literally millions and millions of dollars, thousands of children visiting Disneyland, Disney World, Disney Japan, Disney cruises, just because. So I would say if you lie, qualify the lie right away.
So
but that started the growth. Because of Disney, that immediately started the growth.
Yeah, after that one, that's like getting the whole McCoy right there. Like if you're fishing, that's the big fish. So they really set the leaderboard, and now other organizations have hopped on. Like I've seen banks and hospitals. How many chapters do you have now?
Well, 63 chapters in the United States, 36 international chapters on 5 continents, and the Make-A-Wish Foundation has granted now over 500,000 wishes worldwide, all because of a little boy who wanted to be a motorcycle officer.
Yeah, in November of 1980.
Yeah.
Wow, that's just tremendous. If you have any advice for a nonprofit organization, you're very inspirational, right? And that's what they aspire to be, is to have different chapters and countries and impact. What do you suggest to them?
The biggest thing is the integrity of the foundation. I help a lot of people put together nonprofits. I'm so lucky now that I get to sit on several boards to help promote these nonprofits, things that I'm really involved with, veterans, children, foster kids, and so on. But there's so many that when I talk to people, they say, I want to start this nonprofit. This is my idea. How much money can I make? How much salary can I take? And click, I don't even want to talk to you.
Yeah, because the passion and mission are two different things.
Right. It's not about the mission. It's about them.
Yes.
And I never took a salary. I'm a police officer. I got a salary coming in, so I never took a salary from Make-A-Wish. But that's the biggest thing is accountability. I mean, first the mission, the passion to keep it going. It's not about you. It's about whatever the mission might be. And open books. Open books all the time. Well, where's the money going? Come on. Here, look at the book. Not just, well, we'll put a statement out later. Come on in. Look at the books. We'll show you exactly what
it's an open door.
Yeah.
There's a lot of organizations that are pretty shady, and I've donated to some in the past and then obviously pulled my money and allocated it to somewhere else. I see that millennials are starting a lot of nonprofits. What advice do you have for millennials starting nonprofits now? And they're also responsible for anywhere from $450 to $500 with 3 organizations that they're choosing to donate their money to. So I know that's a loaded question now. So not millennials are donating, but they're also starting nonprofits because they want to work on that triple bottom line. They want to give back more. Mm-hmm. So what do you tell them to do? Just keep open books or?
Well, the same thing. I mean, just base it on integrity, honesty, accountability. And what you talk about millennials, I just recently gave a commencement address at Ohio State University a couple years ago. And just before going in there, I'm reading a USA Today article about millennials and about giving back. Now, this is supposedly the selfish generation.
Yes.
But they're not even graduating yet, and they're thinking, how can I start helping other people? How can I help nonprofits? How can I start nonprofits, but especially helping? We have a program in Make-A-Wish Foundation called Wish Kids. And that started way back in 1983 in Nebraska. And it started in the grade schools because one of the peers, one of the fellow students, had a leukemia and wanted to go on a wish. They started a penny drive. Then they started collecting cans. Then that program moved to the high schools, then to the colleges. I mean, these kids are just giving back.
Right.
They're getting a bad rap, a lot of millennials, you know, the me generation. But that's not true for all of them.
You're right.
Yeah.
I'm surrounded by a lot of millennials. And, you know, I'm close to being a millennial in my age. Thought we'd have a good struggle with that one. But I resonate with their message. I understand what their purpose is and why they want to make the world a better place, because we might not see it in our generation, but they're certainly going to see it in their kids and their grandkids. So it's going to be better for... So Frank, add a little bit more feedback to millennials if you want to send them a message.
Well, one of the big mistakes I made in my younger years that I still make today, and there's a famous speaker named Les Brown, and I was at one of his events where we shared the stage with him, and it's the first time I heard him describe this, and he said, fill your own cup first. And everybody, including me, what do you mean, fill your own cup first? He said, pretend there's money coming in, and you've got your coffee cup. He said, what you need to do is fill that coffee cup first to take care of you, your family, family needs, whatever it is. He said, but when that coffee cup starts overflowing, that's when you start helping other people. And again, I never filled my cup. That was a mistake.
Yeah, but
I made.
You were told to give back at any level. So
right.
Whether it be your time
right.
or, you know, helping someone open a door or sharing a smile.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Well, give back my time. I can do that all the time.
Yeah.
But even during my police career, I used my vacation and everything to promote Make-A-Wish Foundation. But I still think it's a good idea for millennials.
Yeah.
Just take
that's
care
great,
of yourself
great advice.
First. Yeah. Take care of yourself first, your family. And then when you feel comfortable, start helping others.
Yeah, I see that many people, they want to leave a legacy. And unfortunately, you can't leave a legacy until you have money, because you need money to leave a legacy.
Yes.
And when these entrepreneurs are building their thing, their one thing that they're so passionate about, they actually are like, oh, I want to give back too. And it's like Les Brown just said, and you just restated, yeah, fill your cup, because you can't pour from an empty cup, especially even with your health,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
So that's great advice. I love that. I do want to talk about this, the making of the Wish Man. Had a chance to see it. I even bought the DVD. Signed it. I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to like open it now. This is like a treasured piece. So tell us a little bit about that.
I was at a speaking event in San Diego several years ago, and Greg Reed was the host of that, who turned out to be the producer of this movie. And he surprised me on stage. I'm talking, and I'm finished, and he says, what's your wish? And I, what? And he said, what's your wish? I said, well, nobody's ever asked me that. And he said, well, what would your wish be? Do you want a car? Do you want a fancy trip? Do you want more horses? What do you want? And I'm thinking about that. Again, nobody ever asked me that. I never thought about it. And I said, I'd just like my story to be told. I'd like my kids, grandkids to know that dad or grandpa did something cool and forgot about it. Well, there was a movie director in the audience at that time, and he's also seen the reaction of following my presentation. And afterwards, he came out, Greg introduced me to him, and he said, I want to do a movie about your life. I said, no, you don't. He said, yes, I do. And I thought they were talking about a documentary, because I've been involved with some documentaries. And he said, no, we want to do a feature movie. And I thought, well, you know what? This might be, here's the story.
Yeah.
And he explained, yeah, it's going to be a full motion feature. And I've worked with Hollywood before, you know, Hollywood, as we say. And I said, I'll agree to do this, but I want full script approval. Because the movies you go see, it says based on a true story. It's not a true story. But I know we have to give and take on that. And that's why it took 2.5 years for him to write the screenplay with me being the advisor on it all the time. He puts up the flare. I said, Theo, that's just completely crazy. But after 2.5 years, we finally give and take and agreed. And the movie itself was based on a true story. About 70%, which is unusual, is in fact factual for the movie. So we write the screenplay, and now Arizona doesn't give tax credits to Hollywood anymore. But I really lobbied hard to get this film in Prescott, Arizona, or Northern Arizona, because I wanted to, again, give back to the community that helped me out. And, you know, Hollywood comes in with $7 million infused in the local economy. And they said no. So I was also hired as location scouts, go to New Mexico, Georgia, find these things that match that period, 1950 to 1980. But I contacted all my friends who are now business owners in town. Listen, they got a bar scene, and I know you charge $20,000 a night, but come on, just wave it for me. Okay, we'll do it. Go to find an old warehouse. Listen, we want to completely make us a soundstage, offices, everything else, and just donate to us. By the way, I need air conditioning, water, plumbing, everything else. You guys pay for it. Okay, we'll do it. Ended up saving over $1 million. So the production company agreed, okay, we're going to go to Arizona and film that, which was so much fun.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, now we started filming in 2017, and it was a six-week shoot. The actors, the crew that brought in were just fantastic. But one of the
great movie.
Oh, thank you. And it was kind of fun because Larry Wilcox from Chips and I became friends several years ago, and I asked him to do a cameo in the movie. Well, yeah, I'll do it. And I said, we're looking for a sergeant that's going to play my motorcycle sergeant, and Robert Pine, who was Sergeant Gutierrez on Chips, your sergeant, would be perfect for the part. You think he'd do it? And he said, well, let me call Robert. So Robert called me. We sent him a script. He says, I want this. Introduced him to the director. And I mean, this guy's was so much fun having the two of the Chips guys on the set.
How fun.
Well, one of the things on there is I was also a technical advisor, consulting producer. And we, myself and the part of the crew and a script supervisor were the first ones on the set every morning, very early before the actors or anybody else came in. Because we're looking at the script for the day, we're looking at the costumes, the settings, the continuity for maybe a carryover for the next day. And lovely little young gal, Kenny Del Toro from Artesia, New Mexico. She knew who I was. We're getting along just fine. Third day into filming, I come in there, good morning, Kennedy. She looks at me and starts crying and gives me a great big hug. Kennedy, what's wrong? Are you okay? What happened? What did I do? And she said, I'm a wish child. Now, I just started crying. The people that are around her, everybody's crying. I mean, talk about come full circle that she's working on a movie about the creator of the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Yeah. So we just, and now, and real quick about Kennedy, she was, I think, 11. She had this life-threatening illness. She wanted to, her wish was to go to Hollywood to learn how to be an actress. She was too ill. She couldn't do it. When she turned 17, she went into total remission. New Mexico chapter says, do you still want your wish? Well, yes, I do. They sent her to Hollywood. She's going to acting school. She's even got in part of it, one of the Disney films in the background. But she got real interested in the technical side of it. And at the end of the school, one of the directors that was teaching said, Kennedy, I really would like to have you come on as an intern on the production side of it. In fact, I'd like you to be intern for script supervisor, which she had no idea was really what that was. So she did. She spent the year there. In fact, her family even moved from New Mexico to California area so they could be with her. One day, the regular script supervisor show up. The director says, you're the intern. Take care of it for the day. And that's a long, tedious job, a script supervisor. I mean, you're there from morning to night, and then you're already preparing for the next day. The following day, the regular script supervisor didn't show up. He says, she's fired. You're hired. This young lady is all over the world on film, so it's just having the greatest life. And she always thanks me because if it wasn't for Make-A-Wish, it would have never happened.
Amazing. Yeah. There are so many organizations out there. Why is Make-A-Wish so important to you?
Well, it is very important because obviously I'm, let's say, the father. It's my kids. But I never push just Make-A-Wish. You just said the key word. There are so many great organizations out there. Just so many. Make-A-Wish is the biggest known children's charity in the world. for that type of thing. But I'm involved with foster children, they're now 18. I'm involved with homeless veterans. I'm involved with wounded police officers on that. Broadway Hearts, you met Jessica.
Yeah, we had Jessica on the podcast.
Yeah.
She's episode number 85, you're episode number 86.
Okay.
She's a tough act to follow, Broadway.
She is.
You know, not every day we get a Phantom of the Opera star, dancer, ballet. Amazing dancer. If you ever have a chance to go see her perform, she still performs 8 shows a week in Manhattan. So
yeah, and if people don't know, I mean, just a reminder, if it was my Broadway Hearts, I met Jessica about a year ago up in, I think, Washington, D.C., and she said, I've got this nonprofit I'm really putting together. She explained it to me. I said, oh, my God, we got to go. You got to go into the Ronald McDonald houses where these kids are. A lot of Make-A-Wish children come from the children's hospitals all over New York. Sing, dance, do the thing, entertain the kids. And just gave her some input. She asked me to be on the board, which I am. And this is growing. And she said today, this is growing so much. And I told her, they're already asking for franchise for chapters in the theatrical cities, in the San Francisco, Los Angeles, Kansas, Chicago. I mean, this, her foundation is just going to grow and grow. I'm so happy to be part of it.
It's so exciting. And she's such a wonderful, good-hearted. Oh, her heart is huge. She's a tiny little thing, but her heart is huge. She's beautiful inside and out. And so,
she's one of the people, when you ask about it, I do consulting work for nonprofits. When I never tell them what to do. I suggest what you should do. Mm-hmm. Jessica is like a sponge.
She implements.
I mean, she just gets everything in. The next thing I know, I'm getting, no, I did this, I did that, I did. She's getting it done.
So taking action, massive action on something that you really truly believe in is probably a good suggestion that you would suggest. That's super. I think that oftentimes, you know, the book Think and Grow Rich, right? We have this burning desire. I call it the I'll give you the Cliff Note version. There's a pyramid, right, or a triangle, and the bottom is the burning desire, and you have this burning desire to make this thing happen, but nothing really happens until you have the faith and you believe in it, right? But nothing really truly happens until you take massive action.
Right.
And when you take that massive action, exactly what Jessica did and other nonprofits that you are on the board for are doing, they're becoming really successful. And I'm seeing this and I'm talking with them, and Fundraising Secrets hopefully will be at all their hands, and they're going to be listening to it as well. I'm really excited about it, to have this movement, the Fundraising Secrets Mastery Movement. I'm so excited to teach people how to become better fundraisers and effective fundraisers and get this message out to the world, and hopefully that will be my give back. A little bit about me is, when I was pregnant with my daughter 20 years ago, the doctors basically told me to abort my baby, and it's because she was having all these medical complications. It was springtime, 10 o'clock in the morning, my husband's sitting in a chair, I'm laying on the bed, doctor comes in with the sheet, and he's like looking it over, it doesn't look that good. I didn't really know that, so he basically handed me a pamphlet and said, well, these are the birth complications, and if I were you, I'd just abort her. So my insurance, being an entrepreneur, you know, we don't have the best insurance out there, and we run out really, you know, it's limited. So I was like, well, I need second opinions, and that one told me the same thing, and I went to third opinion, and that one told me the same thing, and I'm like, nope, I don't believe it. So I went until the day I didn't have any more money, and I went to Catholic Charities, and that's who helped me to get the right answer, because we believe what we want to hear, right? Mm-hmm. We're not going to stop until we hear that one thing. And thank God I didn't listen. She is now 19, studying medicine at the University of Colorado Boulder. And, you know, so I do fear some days, like, maybe something will happen, because, you know, you don't know when they're so far away from New York, right? But she's thriving and doing really well, and I'm so proud of her. But I didn't listen to that one thing. And so many times people tell us things that we should listen to, especially a person like a doctor, right, or a lawyer, someone of authority. And I chose to go against the grain, which is kind of the person I am. Mm-hmm. So, but that's a little backstory on me on why I'm doing this nonprofit work. And there's so, I talk to so many moms, and they have been told the same thing, to abort their babies, and they're healthy babies, and like, I don't understand it, like, what's happening. And I spoke to a mom during this event as well, and she says, like, my story, like, made her arms, the hairs on her arms raise, because she's like, oh my God, I hope we didn't have the same doctor, because he said that to me. And her child was born with some type of a birth defect, either not spinal bifida, but Down syndrome. And my daughter was born healthy. But she says, I love that baby more than anything in the world. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so, but there's organizations that she started something as well to bring more awareness to children of, with disabilities.
Right.
So, and I've been helping organizations such as NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, because I feel like that all plays a part in. And in 10 weeks, we raised $100,000 for them. 12 weeks, I apologize. 12 weeks, $100,000 for them to help end the stigma surrounding mental illness and depression and schizophrenia and, you know, raise awareness. It's not going to end it, right? But right. at least it's something to help. So I want to get the message to Fundraising Secrets, and that's why I appreciate you so much for sitting down and spending such quality time with me and talking about podcasts on this podcast, Fundraising Secrets, so that people can really see that it just starts with you. You have the power to be that change. And we have to put into it in order to get out into this world. So, Frank, before we wrap up, how can people get involved with Make-A-Wish?
Well, if you want to get involved with Make-A-Wish, wish.org is the website, and they have right on the top chapter locator. So, because we're all literally obviously all over the world, but for the United States, just put in your zip code, and it will take you to the chapters in your area. Like in New York, I believe there's 4 chapters in New York State. Some states are only 1 chapter, but it will take you to that local chapter. You pull it up on their website. You find out what's going on. They have volunteer opportunities, give back, whatever it might be, in-kind donations. See if it's something you're interested in. Simple as that. But any nonprofit, I mean, they've got just go to their website, find out what's going on.
Yeah, I love that you support every nonprofit. And even though you're the Wish Man, how, if someone went to watch Wish Man, how could they do that?
We finished our theatrical release, and I'm going to boast here a little bit.
Please do.
We just got qualified for Academy Award for Best Independent Film. I mean, I can't even believe that happened with such a low-budget film, but we just got qualified on that. The Academy votes in December. We're going to see what happens. I mean, I know it's a long shot, but in a racetrack, sometimes they come in, right? But right now we're on DVD, and the DVD sales are just going crazy. You can order online, but we have also on Amazon Prime, Hulu, all of those types of streaming video-on-demand type devices. It looks like we're going to sign a contract with Netflix coming up. Netflix is very interested. Netflix likes to wait after things die down, and then they can start promoting again, which is great for us. So, but right now, like I said, it's on video on demand on several applications. It's available in the stores to buy for the CDs. You can contact me direct for an autographed CD or an autograph. We're even talking about my book, which was the movie is inspired by.
Oh, well, we have time. Talk about your book, then. Let's hear about it. Talk about your book. Well, I'm surprised you didn't have a copy of this. This is like all about you.
The book is the real story.
Oh.
The movie is
based on. Now that we know Hollywood talk, yes.
But, I've got a Facebook page. Friend me on Facebook. Or you can go to my website also, Wishman1, the number one, wishman1.com. And you can contact me there, order a book, DVD, whatever you need to do.
Yeah. You do realize you just gave everyone, over 8,000 people, and I'm sure we'll hit 10K by 2020 now that you've given everybody your email on the podcast Fundraising Secrets.
Well, next week, in fact...
I'm going to change it next week.
Yeah. when I leave here, I go straight to Hollywood, and we're appearing on Inside Edition, and we're appearing on Hallmark Family and Home and Family Show. And now, I'm not going to put you down a little bit, but each one is 4 million viewers per day, and we're going to promote the movie and the book.
Ah, all right.
So we're going to exceed a little bit the 8,000.
Well, they heard it here on Fundraising Secrets first, because Netflix is waiting for you to be a little outdated, but we've got the current stuff here. We got the hots. We got the mots. Tell us a little bit about your book. Is your book called Wish Man?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's the one that inspired the movie. The minute that we talked about it, the director read the book. And again, like I said, it's based. Now, we don't want to do this. And in the book, there's a negative part of my career, the Howard Troll, that's featured in the movie. And he said, I've read the book, but everything is kind of positive. You had a lot of hiccups. It wasn't all lollipops and rainbows and so on. What the negative thing in your life? And I said, well, and then I started telling the story. That's what we need, because those actors need that arc. It's not just flat line like a documentary. So that's the difference between the movie and the book, that one particular part.
There was a part in the movie that your wife played a cameo, and she's such an inspiration to many as well, because you're not alone.
Oh, no.
And
no.
Tell us about Kitty.
Well, Kitty, I met her. She was a secretary for the Arizona Highway Patrol. In fact, I had 42 years of service as a police officer. She had 44 years of service as a civilian employee. But we just knew each other, and then when we started this 10-man motorcycle squad travel all over the state, when all 10 of us were together under very intense situations, she was our traveling secretary. We'd rough out a report. She'd get them typed up, get them to the court, because we're working 15, 20-hour days every day. And when I had this accident in this little town of Park, Arizona, there's no hospital. There's a little clinic, is it? And I was too injured to get transported back to Phoenix and put in a motel room. And they said, we need somebody to stay with him for a couple of days to keep him from going into shock. And the sergeant said, Kitty, that's your job. A little bit different from the, we knew each other at the time. And that's when we kind of started paying attention to one another. And when I started the Make-A-Wish Foundation, I asked her if she would be a board member, if she would help. Yes, I would. And then we connect a little bit more. And then I like to say, 3 years later, people ask me, did you ever get your wish? Well, I did. 3 years later, I asked her to marry, and she said, I do. So that was my wish came true.
You've been getting plenty of wishes granted, and you've granted many after that. So you're good. This has been so much fun. I really appreciate you and your time. I know you're busy. I know you're going to be headed to...
What happened to 15 minutes?
Well, I figured that once we started talking, you know, we got champagne here and strawberries and sitting back and just chatting. It's been great, and I look forward to a continued friendship. And, guys, you just heard all the stories that Frank unleashed here on Fundraising Secrets. If you like this podcast, like it, subscribe, and share. Rate us on Apple Podcasts. Share this with a nonprofit organization that needs this message. And be the voice. And you know what? Thank you so much for listening and sharing and contributing, subscribing. I know I'm asking a lot, but let's get started. Let's do this. Let's get Fundraising Secrets to the people that need it. So I'm Maya McNulty. I maximize fundraising by thinking like an entrepreneur. Thanks for joining me, everyone. I'll catch you on the next episode. Want more great content? Head on over to our Facebook page, Fundraising Secrets. Don't forget to subscribe and rate our podcast. Thank you for sharing this episode, and we'll catch you next time on Making Fundraising Fun Again. This is the podcast, Fundraising Secrets, and I'm Maya McNulty.